The Uncompelling In-Between, a story by John Paul Rollart. The old man will wave at her. Every day he waves at her. But she will not wave back. She never waves back. And she certainly won't sit next to him, not in the seat he welcomes her to, the one safe for a guest who never seems to arrive. She will find another seat on the bus, or if all the seats are taken, all but one, she will stand. Today, she will stand. She is not late. She is never late. This she is good at. A simple task she has mastered. There are many of these tasks at her job. She has mastered them all. They have allowed her to become a principal deputy assistant at some such in company, or you know that one place limited. Not everyone could get this job. More than she'd like to think. It's a good job, though. Good enough, at least. The details would bore you. She doesn't know this. Or maybe she does. At moments. When she stops long enough to look at someone. And stops staring at the next screaming need. All this at 37. No. 38. Mornings are email. Email the afternoons. The shudder and squeak of email as she makes her way home. She is a switchman for simple decisions. A one-word world. Yes, no, 6, 7, great, now. Always looking ahead, straight ahead, to the subsequent line on her screen. Unless there is someone to look at, someone she should look at. There is Larry, her boss, Delilah, his, others beyond, though they don't look at her. She always looks surprised to see them, in the lounge, in the hall, at the midday meeting, always. They've noted this. Laughed about it behind her back. The worst is at her desk. She greets them with upsnapped neck, eyes open shutter, lips lightly ajar, breathless. It is the appearance of ready words, awaited instruction, of answers aching to explode. For others, those she needn't look at, the nameless beneath her, there is only dread. The look, however, is one and the same. This doesn't confound most people in her office. Do you think she's the only one? Only Andrej, who gathers her trash. He is talkative. He likes to talk. He stood by her desk for 27 minutes one day and talked. Almost half an hour. It was Sunday morning, and they were the only people on the floor. He used his hands when he talked. He has large hands. He liked to wave them. Constantly. Look, he said, pointing to the window. She looked. You seen, no? She looked left, right. Shook her head. Look, he implored. The park. She looked at the park. There were children there, streaming from the playground, filling the empty lawn. They surrounded a man on stilts. He looked lost among them, began to waver. Listen, he said. She listened. You hear? She shook her head. Listen, he commanded. Gentle. Firm. They scream. The next morning, Andrej waved at her, and every day that week, but she never noticed him. She was too busy staring at her screen. Andrej is not the man on the bus. That is another man, older still. She will look at him today, briefly. Why, you ask? One cannot tell. Humans are not perfect, even in their imperfections. So she will look at him, steal a glance. She'll look at his hands. He has large hands like Andrej, skin-cracked knuckles, black with mossy hair. He stares at them like a fool, like he bought them from a street vendor and refused to take a bag. She will smile at this. It is not a pleasant smile. She should keep it to herself. He will stop looking only to raise his hands and wave when someone new arrives, to show them the seat that no one will want. He will do this to the women. He always does this to the women. But occasionally the men, too, the young ones especially, the handsome kind, like the man who will stand next to her when he boards. He will see the old man, see him wave, then he will pretend he saw nothing. He will crowd in next to her, the prow of his chest barely touching her arms. When the bus stops, he will ease into her, she him when it moves again. He will smell of cinnamon. Deeply she will inhale. She is not married. You've guessed this, have you? But she would like to be. She doesn't admit this, not to herself, not even to her friends. It would be too painful to concede such things. Must she scream, "Time, time, there isn't much time!" No. No one would expect that. Besides, there's no need. Whispered ways are enough. Go to her home, condo, single bath, alley view. Look at the magazines, the pages she lingers over. There on the end table, all glossy, few words, photos of the same 7 people. Some of the pages are folded, a little triangle, a minor fold. She doesn't know she does this. Blind habit, we all have them. She folds the pages she likes, the ones she feels in her heart. Once they were of men, unfathomable men, rising from the ocean, perched on motorcycles, inexplicably muscled. No more. Now they are of strollers, tiny bows, the suspension bridge of hands. These are the pages she lingers over. She spends too much time on them, the stories they intend. She doesn't know this. You would. Listen to her talk. Dinners with the girls, the occasional Sunday brunch, internet chats, reams of email, gossip, 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 about people she doesn't know, people she'll never meet, people who would never speak to her, not even if she wept before them, bore their children, expired at their feet. Really, it's hard to bear. But we all need things to talk about, to remind us day by day that our time is being spent. And if we have nothing ourselves to speak of, nothing to look forward to, so what if we steal from others? What have we to borrow against? Nothing. For 2 years, nothing. There has been nothing. That's when Brad left. It was past time, seriously. 7 years of dating? That's a long time to wait for nothing. Yet if she'd been honest with herself, this, you may have noticed, is not one of her gifts. She would have seen the something for the nothing it was. How else to describe Brad? The sulky disinclination to kisses? The foot dragging with family introductions? The stubborn forgetfulness of every special day? For a long time she thought he hid his affections. In the end the cupboard was bare. What there was habit, stable inclination, routine. Don't laugh, these can mean a lot. The world, really. Say what you will about a seat warmer. He keeps his seat warm. The loss is keenly felt, though it grins and whispers, "You're a fool." This is what struck her, the foolishness. How foolish it all was. What a waste. 7 years. 7 years and never a sense of love. Only gray tumblers of momentum, turning of their own accord, taking their own time to slow. Long after Brad, she'd seen a movie. The protagonist, she would have called her the hero, but that would have been the wrong word, comes to realize that the man she has suffered over, who breaks her heart early in the movie, and whom she spends the subsequent 97 minutes lamenting, that man is a cad, a creep, a zero, an unworthy, a dick. In the end, she confronts him. What does she say? She can't remember. She wishes she could. She would have repeated the words to herself over and again, but she can't. It went something like, "When I cried in your arms, it was one of the tenderest moments of my life. We only get a few of these moments, maybe just one, and I can only feel it was wasted on you. My moment was wasted on you. Waste, waste, absolute waste." She wishes she had said that to Brad, but then again there never was such a moment, not even at the end. She is left wishing there had been one. Has she ever been in love? Good question. She would say, yes, of course. But we would doubt her answer. She should. If we told her so, she would object, but we could convince her otherwise. No, it is not true that 7 years side by side is unmistakable evidence of love. It is not true that saying you love someone makes it so. And it is certainly not true that being 37 means you must have been in love. Even 38. What is the closest she came? We're not allowed to thumb through the private files of the mind, and many of the cabinets are locked anyway, but were hers open to us? Were we to pull forth the drawers, we would find a knight, a boy, no more than 17. Younger, maybe. She was patient with him, coy. Let him think he picked her up. They went back to her cabin, lower deck, second class. Sealed away from the world, they made love and darkness absolute. It was fumbling, aggressive, brief. When it was done, she lay there and listened to the distant violence of the engines. For a time, nothing. Then she felt trembling. It was his first time, she knew. She looked over. Then she leaned forward until her lips found a shoulder. She kissed it. Once. Then again, quickly. His breathing slowed. She leaned back. A moment passed. Then the palate shifted. Fingers, one, two, brushed her shoulder. They hesitated. Then they traced the curve of her neck, rolling up over her chin, one, two. They paused again. He was breathing, quickly now. Then they moved north to the soft rise of her lips. There they stopped. They pressed once, gently. Then again, and again, over and again, as if in wonder. The next morning they arrived in port. It was her birthday. She was 32. Not that she will think of this, not with a man smelling of cinnamon next to her. She will spend their time together breathing deeply, searching every movement, the glance at a watch, a tug at one ear, the shifting of weight, for the unmistakable sign of destiny. Until the bus will stop, and the man will start, and again she will be alone. The space will not remain empty, not for long, only the seat will. She will turn to it now. Empty, red, something scrawled along the back. A lewd drawing, an arrow, a foul word. The old man could put his bags there, but he will keep them on his lap. A gesture that will go unreciprocated, a gesture that always goes unreciprocated. A waste. She will watch that seat until the space next to her is filled. A woman, a younger woman, clutching a squirming baby. She will stand by her side. The old man will watch. He will have been watching from the moment the child appeared. And he will smile and wave. Of course he will wave. The woman will try not to notice, but the baby will stare. The bus will grow quiet when the baby begins to wave. The old man will wave harder. The baby will giggle and try to keep up. Finally, the old man will laugh, a hoarse, heavy sound, like the cry of a dying hound, and the woman will turn the child away. Somewhere, deep inside, she will feel a stab of pain. Her niece stares at her. She's noticed this. In the car, at the dentist, on the playground, Stephanie, her sister will say, it's not nice to stare. And the little girl with those brown and bottom eyes will blink and look away. Then again, Stephanie is nearly five. And when you are nearly five, there is much to stare at. Silent arguments through shut windows, the strange gait of small dogs, and the crooked arm of trees. A world unspoken. One doesn't know when to stare and when to look away. Her father looks away. It's instinct by now, second nature. Besides, it's easier to look at Stephanie. She's a good child with a growing repertoire. She favors dolls, her cat Smelly, and the paper chain of questions she likes to drape about her parents. She also favors her grandpa. Papa, she calls him. She brings him bags of black licorice and sits with him in the garden whenever he tends to his tomatoes. He reciprocates with peppermints and ready approval whenever she proposes a child's movie he's seen 17 times before. Maybe it is the presence of another, warm and trusting, that sees him smile. But there is also the fragrant haystack of hair, the spindly legs she tucks under his, and the way she always turns to him with parsonical solemnity to warn him what's ahead. Whatever it is, it shouldn't be surprising. It isn't to her. She was that girl once. Not recently, of course, but not so long ago either. At least not long enough. Besides, Stephanie is a natural. That's probably why she hates her. Yes, hates her. It's a recent development, a revelation, really, and it's a terrible thing. She knows it is a terrible thing, but like much in her life, most things, really, she can't help it. She realized it at Thanksgiving. Stephanie was seated next to her papa, who stood behind her and prepared her meal, a miniature of his own. She watched agreeably while the plates circled overhead, until a single gold medallion landed squarely on her plate. A candied yam, stuccoed in chopped pecans. She'd never seen one before. It did not look like something she should eat. It did not look like something anyone should eat. She stared at it, then she sat back from the table, stunned. A tiny sob began welling in her throat. In a moment, she would weep. Papa put his hand on her shoulder. "It's all right," he said, and like a crane bent over and plucked the offending yam from her plate. He stood up, chewing happily, then darted back for two errant pecans until all that remained was a sticky eclipse of sugar in the center of Stephanie's plate. On his second return, he gave his granddaughter a kiss, a smack, really. Stephanie giggled and rubbed her cheek. The dishes continued their rounds. Later, when he began eating his own yams, Stephanie looked on intently until he cut an orange crescent and delivered it to her mouth. He grinned and looked around. They did the dishes when they were done. Papa would wash a plate and hand it to Stephanie, who would immediately hand it to her mother, who'd dry the plate and place it on the rack. The inessential role delighted Stephanie, who watched the parade of plates with rapt attention while the adults chatted amiably overhead. She remembers all this, but mostly she remembers watching them from the far end of the table. She could only hear shards of the conversation. Her mother was too busy boring her with some indignity of old age, but the words were unnecessary. Had they been unbroken, she might have paid them too much attention and missed the shape of the exchange. For that is what struck her, what stuck with her, how it seemed so, the word dragged its feet, natural. Her conversations were no longer natural, not with her father, not anymore. They were stilted, forced, the stiff embrace of a former love. It was not that her father fumbled for words. He simply had nothing to say. He would try, he always tried, but the words were perfunctory. Boxes to be checked. Routine. Still she talked. Of course she talked. The opportunities to unburden herself were so few. And whenever her concerns were uncorseted, when she opened to him the dreary daily planner of her life, the steady disappointments, shallow hopes, profane marginalia, his smile would strain, and soon he'd forget to blink. Small suffering. A man hearing favors he cannot grant. She's not oblivious to his discomfort, though she talks it up to the narrow compass of a man's imagination. Her father's comfortable with the candid compliance of little girls. With a woman, she thinks, he's lost. And there is truth in this, though not nearly truth enough. She was his favorite once. The tired child who crawled into her father's lap. The little girl whose tea parties made him the honored guest. The young woman who urgently requested approval of dresses, of boys, he never refused to give. Familiar scenes? Yes, but we all play them, one way or another. That's why they're familiar. Hers were played for her father, always her father, as if she sensed early on that her mother was out of reach. And he reciprocated, no more than a parent ought to, which is far more than most do. Small tokens, ample hugs, remembered dates. He was a good father. He played his part. But the part has changed. She has changed. And he has not. He has not changed. And what is she supposed to do? Stand around while Stephanie reads her lines? No, it's not fair. It's not. She must have a part to play. Better to be written out altogether than to fall from the spotlight and remain on stage. For nobody knows what to do with you. They strain to see through you, to pretend you're not there, but you are there, you're always there, with no one calling your name. And maybe that's best. For when they do turn to you, for they must, every once in a while they must, they have that look, and you can tell. They don't know what to say. Perhaps that's why she's learned not to look at others, not closely, not even when she's staring at them. It's easier that way. We all do it. We must. If we followed the winding story of every wounded soul, we'd never get to work in the morning. The checkout line would be a nightmare. The DMV a tomb. Anyway, there's no need. The cliches of near certainty are enough. To be mostly right pays for the occasional wrong. To be always right would bankrupt us. We're all part of the same conspiracy. We know how far to press. She does. Of her few gifts, this is the greatest, worthy of a story all its own. Work days without resistance, a social life pasteurized and skim, just enough to keep one moving, unencumbered and anonymous, and generally without complaint. Yes, without complaint. For this is not a tragedy. No murder, no plague, no redemption. Not even a fist raised and shaken. Keep moving, she might say. There's nothing here to see. And people do. They pass by her, a pale daub in a gross gallery of faces. And this is what she prefers. Not ideally, of course. But then again, there are no ideals here. You should know that by now. If you don't, you haven't been paying attention. There is only the fate handed you. To demand more is to make a scene, and you don't want to make a scene. For if you never ask anyone to look closely, you needn't look at yourself. And you don't want to look at yourself. In the broad bower of indifference, there is ample room to hide. But now I have outed her, flushed her from the bushes, naked in the light of day. It's not fair. No, it's not. She would never have asked for it, begged for me to stop. But I didn't stop. I kept on going. Wouldn't listen. Honestly, I didn't try. So this is not her story. It's mine. It's my story. And what is it about? It's not about a bad person, no. But not a good person either. Someone caught in the uncompelling in-between. Like now, when the bus will stop, and the people will start, and she will turn to the rear. She will see the old man, see his empty seat. She will find him in a moment of small discovery. For his mouth will open, and his eyes will grow, and he will lean toward the window. And when he begins to wave, for of course he will wave, she will forget herself and struggle to see. But she will not see. For all along the bus, the uprising has begun. The gathering of goods, the aisle flood, the strong push to the front. The people will wash over her, but she will not be moved. She will stand her ground. For once, she will not be carried away. All while the waving grows, the incessant waving, frantic nearly. And it is only when the aisle has emptied, before the doors close and the bus begins to move, only then will she see what he sees, a woman with black bovine eyes. It is winter, and she is sitting alone along the sidewalk, head exposed in a high-backed wheelchair, her shriveled body broken, wedged at right angles in the seat. And in her heart she'll hear the screaming when the bus pulls away. Wave! Wave! Wave!